Split program tonight, sometime tonight. Past life regressionist Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins us, but we'll be back with more with the author of The World is Curved, David Schmick, on Coast to Coast AM. David, isn't it interesting, too, that how this economic disaster has taken everyone's minds off other issues, like the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, Border Patrol, and everything else? It's just like nothing else exists anymore.
Right. And you worry right now about the big surprise in one of those areas that, you know. We never expect it, you know, and then,
yep.
Boom. It's frightening.
What would you do today as an individual to try to weather this storm for yourself and your family?
Well, you know, I would normally look at the situation and say, well, you know, 2009 will be a year where we'll probably go for a couple more quarters of very, very bad growth, but then we'll bottom out, and you know, the stock market, the equity market will be the first to turn, and then by 2010 everything will start to turn upward, and I would make that argument or make that case because you know, these things move in cycles. These are dramatic times right now. The thing that makes me nervous and why I really would say to be very, very cautious right now is that we're not just in a domestic economy, we're in a global economy. And as bad as things are in the U.S., believe it or not, I think they're worse around the world.
I think you're right.
We are seeing the collapse of, you know, the model that under which the world has operated for the last two decades. And that model, particularly emerging markets, you know, the Chinas and the Indias and Russia and Brazil and Eastern Europe, that model said that basically you tie your currency to the dollar and you set up your economy as kind of an export platform, and you don't have a lot of consumption, and you export. And who do you export to? United States, because Americans are, you know, up until recently, we were the consumers of the world. We consume more than we earned, and we were, the world lent us the money. And so with this collapse in the U.S. of consumption, the rest of the world's in deep trouble, because the rest of the world allowed itself to become export dependent. And so even a country like Germany, massively export dependent, between 40% and 50% of its GDP depends on exports. But China, deep trouble right now. You look around the world, Eastern Europe, big problems. Why? There's no one to export to. And so we're seeing the collapse of the, you know, the global kind of emerging market export model.
Could this be a plan to get this one world economy together with this one world government, one currency,
you know,
one everything?
Well, you know, I think at this point, I don't see a whole lot of cooperation right now to have any one world. I mean, I think that countries now are having to go back and try to rebuild their economies quickly to be more balanced. Give you an example. Look at the Chinese. You know, they suddenly are in a. I mean, the Chinese, China's economy is momentum driven, heavily dependent on being able to export to the world, particularly to the U.S. China's
right.
Exports are collapsing. So what are they doing now? Well, they passed a massive fiscal stimulus plan because they want to have a consumer economy. I don't think that's going to be easy for the Chinese.
And they can't do it overnight, Dave.
The Japanese tried in the 90s 8 stimulus packages. It's very hard when you have an aging population with no Social Security system, as the Chinese have, to make suddenly have people become consumers. I mean, the image I have, it's like kind of a half joke, but I can see, you know, Chinese authorities driving around, you know, knocking on people's doors and saying, when the guy comes to the door, the older couple, he's, you know, the authority says, where's your new flat screen? Where's your new, let me see your toaster. Oh, this is an old toaster. Come with me. You know, how do you force people who and they, you know, everybody has information now. They know the world economy is in trouble, but you know, how do you make them become consumers? The rest of the world's in deep trouble because they don't have an economic engine.
Well, do they even have the money to become a consumer?
Well, not, no, that's a good point. I mean, they don't, you know, these economies now, they you know, you say, why would they just want exports? Because if you can, or an economy that's dominated by exports, my theory is that the elites, they can control exports. You know, if you're exporting to the U.S. and we're sending back our dollars, you know, as the Chinese, for example, the Chinese can build a mountain of reserves in dollars, and the elites can control that. It's subject to graft and all the rest. If you have a broad-based economy of consumer, you know, thriving consumers, you know, the elites can't control, the party can't control that. That's wealth in the hands of the people. And so, but I think you've got this. When I look around the world, I say I'm worried because of the global financial system. There's a German word called Schadenfreude, which, when translated, means gaining pleasure at the misery of others. And for up until a couple months ago, for the last year prior to that, you know, the Europeans and particularly the Germans had these feelings of Schadenfreude toward the U.S. They said, "Oh, these poor Americans and their subprime problems of their own makings." Well, it turns out that the European banks today are six times as exposed to, you know, the emerging market problems and the potential for default than we are to subprime. I mean, it is amazing the European exposure that, for example, you look at, I'll give you one European bank, UBS, the largest bank in Switzerland. Its exposure to emerging market debt, but you know, by UBS, mm-hmm. is 400. The exposure is 450% of Switzerland's GDP. And you look at the Austrian banks. Austria's a member of the monetary union, and you say, and Austria, its banks, its exposure to Eastern European investments is, I just looked up the numbers, it's 290 billion. Austria's GDP is 370. The British banks have huge exposure to emerging markets. The five largest British banks, their exposure is 450% of GDP, above the British GDP. So what does all this mean? It means that you know, if one of these big banks in Europe goes down, that's going to affect our financial system because we're all interconnected, and it's very frightening. So, I mean, I would look and say, you know, the usual process in the U.S. where you say, well, we'll start to recover this year, you know, you'd normally expect that to happen, except I'm worried about what's happening overseas, particularly as you start to see defaults. You'll see defaults. You're already seeing Hungary's already collapsed. They had to go to the IMF for emergency assistance. I'm worried about Eastern Europe. I'm worried about China.
And we can't prop up the world.
We can't, and the IMF doesn't have the money. And you know, it's frightening right now when you look at the kind of exposure. So, you know, that's why I'm a little hesitant about this notion. This is going to be real. A typical, you know, business cycle. It's maybe a little deeper than usual. I mean, I would like to see Obama, when he gets in, to follow up. I thought one of the things that Bush did it didn't accomplish much, but at least it set the agenda where they kind of got together internationally and tried to, because I think they need to, I don't believe in this world government stuff, but I do think they need to have the lines of communication open so we don't have the Chinese or somebody doing something stupid, because that's what happened in the 30s.
What would be stupid?
Well, you know, suddenly you end up with like a trade. This is not the time to have a trade war right now, where you get the Chinese moving capital which would be stupid for them, but to start massively trying to sell our treasury market. I don't think they would. I think that they probably, what I'm hearing, a lot of Chinese investors are so skeptical of their own system now.
They're glad they've
they're
got
trying
ours,
to get the money out.
Yeah.
And, you know, ironically, you know, you would think that given all of our problems in the U.S., right, you look at the Federal Reserve is like, I mean, massively expanding its balance sheet. We're taking on massive debt from all these bailouts. And we got a flatlining economy, right? That's usually a recipe for a crashing dollar, right?
Yep.
The dollar's not crashing.
It's not crashing.
The reason is because the rest of the world, people know that, you know, that they're not far behind, and people are trying to get into the U.S. They're trying to get into the dollar because, relative to the rest of the world, we actually look, safe, and we have institutions that historically, or at least knock on wood, have been reliable. But it's very, very frightening.
There's a part of me, David, that thinks this was all planned.
Well, you never know. I mean, it's certainly, if it wasn't planned, it's kind of like, it's like we're snake bit. It's everything that could go wrong seems to be going wrong. You know, it's like, every step of the way. I'll give you another concern that I have.
Sure.
And, you know, when I look at, I mean, I go into in my book, The World is Curve, I talk about, you know, I call it the chapter on central banks, I call the incredible shrinking central bank. But I worry about the Fed for this reason. I mean, you know, right now we have deflation, prices coming down. And so the Fed, to counter that, has not just slashed interest rates from 5.25% down to zero or near zero, but they're doing something called quantitative easing, which means they're just going in and buying up securities. They're buying everything they can find, regardless of the quality of the security. You know, they'll buy Fannie and Freddie debt. They'll just, you know, trying to
with phony money, right?
Yeah, exactly. Trying to find this thing. So you in like one 30-day period, might have been 40-day period, the Fed's balance sheet. And the Fed has a balance sheet.
But
like a company. It
jumped
130%.
David, isn't the Fed put together and owned by the same banks that are failing?
Yeah, well, it's basically they're all part and parcel. They all own each other at this point.
It's weird.
But, you know, you say to yourself, it's deflation now. But imagine, you know, 2011, 2000, not that long from now.
No, not at all.
All right.
Don't believe me.
You wonder if we're, you know, as the global economy by then starts to recover, and if we're looking at a world-class round of inflation. I mean, you know, no, it seems absurd to think about inflation today, you know, because of everything that's going on. But we are creating so much debt. And now, when when the government says that 2009 is going to be at the beginning of 2009, the deficit is going to be $1.2 trillion. Let me tell you what
Which seems like nothing.
That means
now.
That means it's going to be $2 trillion.
Yep.
All right. And that means, I mean, a lot of people, you know, who are experts in looking at budget, I mean, they're doing back of the envelope calculations, and they could see us on course for like a $15 to $20 trillion debt. And to put it in perspective, our GDP is only $14 trillion. So we're kind of moving toward the territory of being another Argentina if we're not careful.
Is there any way we could just start all over?
Well,
forgive everybody's debt, everything. Just
Well, you know, that's kind of a biblical concept, right? Every 70 years, you know. Well, you know, there may be, that's part of my, when we discussed earlier, the whole notion of nationalizing the banks temporarily. You nationalize the banks, get rid of the toxic waste, remove the management, and cut up these giant dinosaurs into smaller units and all this. The only problem is, you know, the idea of Washington being able to restructure the banks. Washington usually has a hard time, as we saw with Katrina, they have a hard time organizing a two-car funeral, much less restructuring the banks. But, you know, back on the whole question of the Fed, the way I try to explain it is, imagine, you know, 2011, you know, you got a table, and on one end of the table was a brick, And around that brick is a giant rubber band. And on the other side of the table is Washington, his Uncle Sam, and both the Federal Reserve and also, you know, Congress. And we are increasing not only the money supply, but the debt. And we're pulling on that rubber band, and the brick isn't moving. And we're saying, look, we can get away with massive amounts of debt, but eventually you've got to come to terms with how you deal with the debt. And you either raise taxes, and now they're running out of wealthy people because they've all lost their money in the stock market.
Mm-hmm. They're hurt, sure.
So you're going to be raising taxes on people who consider themselves middle class, and which will be very difficult politically. Or you do the other alternative is you monetize the debt. In other words, more inflation. And inflation usually doesn't just appear in little bits. It tends to build up. One minute it's not happening, and then you keep pulling on that rubber band, and all of a sudden one day, whether it's 2011, 2012, the brick starts to move. And then you keep pulling on the rubber band at the other end of the table, and suddenly, boom, the brick goes sliding across the table and hits you in the face. And that's the danger that we face. People ask me, should I sell my real estate? I say, sell your real estate. I mean, at this point,
who's going to buy it, first of all?
Who's going to buy it? And it's got to be in the worst possible. That's probably the one thing you'd hang on to if, in fact, we're going to, there's no market for it, but, you know, you could be in a market, you know, a number of years from now, maybe sooner than we expect, because I don't see any other way out of this debt situation except they'll probably monetize it, which means they'll more inflation. The Fed chairman Bernanke's theory is that they'll be able to catch it in time. They'll switch policy, That means you're raising interest rates by 75 and 100 basis points, and he'll probably be long gone. That's very hard to do.
Now, here's the thing I don't understand, David. If they're merely just printing up money with nothing behind it, nothing backing it up, why aren't other countries doing the same thing?
Well, they are. And you know what? They're about to. And there's a theory right now. You know, I talked about the 8 bubbles.
Yeah.
Well, we may have a 9th. That's the government bond market bubble. Because it's not just the Fed now, all these other central banks now and governments now are moving in the same direction. They're suddenly doing huge fiscal stimulus packages, following up on ours, and they are the same thing. They're cutting interest rates. I mean, the Bank of England, you know, has had dramatic cuts of their short-term interest rates. The European Central Bank, the last move recently was 75 basis points. Everybody's cutting rates. They're all following our lead. And, of course, you know, investors are now pouring into their government bond markets. So we're getting this kind of potential bond market bubble. And that's the next bubble. And you know, with all this, you know, all this world's, you know, capital kind of flooding in there. Now, what happens when, you know, the economy turns and we suddenly get a bout of inflation and suddenly you get a bloodbath in those bond markets? So I hate to be so scary here, but I can tell you that's what the really smart money in the global financial system is thinking about right now. Is the bond market the next bubble?
What happens with people who can't find work?
Well, it's going to, you know, there will be.
We're talking about civil unrest here.
Yeah, I think we are talking about there's a loss of hope, and people are angry. I mean, give you a little window of what the world could look like.
All right, let's talk about that when we come right back, David. The window, if it all happens. We'll take your phone calls next hour with our guest, the author of The World is Curved, David Smick, in just a moment. But we'll be back with him and continue talking about these incredible things going on with the economy. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. David, you were talking about possible scenarios and outcomes, and I'll let you pick it up from there.
Well, yeah, you had mentioned the potential for violence. And, you know, it's a friend of mine whose son was is getting married. They came by for dinner the other night, and I said, "Where are you going on your honeymoon?" And he said, "Well, we're thinking of going to Greece." I said, "You ought to reconsider that." But here you have the Europeans. I mean, you look and you think we're all, you know, we're in 21st century. They're part of the, you know, European economy. They're part of the monetary union there. And you think, okay, look at what's going on in Greece. You know, it's anarchy.
Yeah,
I mean, the youth riots are it's beyond belief. And it's not. And what has been striking is that the government's going along with it. I mean, major politicians are saying they have a right to
be upset.
To do this, and they should be, and we're for them. And as they're looting and burning out every building, I mean, it's massive class warfare. And why? Because youth unemployment is at least 30%, and it's probably higher. The unofficial, you know, officially 30%, but there are a lot of young people in their early 20s, particularly males, who just aren't, you know, don't even try to find jobs. So they're, at this point, you know, it could be anywhere from, you know, 50% to 60%. And you say, and it is chaos, and it's just, you know, it's destroying the country. And you, and that's what happens when people lose hope. And you have Europe for too long said, well, we don't need to, you know, to worry about this. And here's the problem for the Europeans, and it's a window for us to look in to see what we could easily become quickly. You know, the unemployment rate among, you know, young people in Greece is basically the same as it is in Spain and Italy and even France. The difference in France, it's a big Muslim youth population. So, you know, there's a real potential for this, for, you know, as the global economy weakens, for there to be, you know, chaos and anarchy. And then we look at it and we say, well, that can't happen here. Well, it can. And it's certainly, you know, it's Obama's right to, you know, in his campaign literature to concentrate on hope, because if we get to a point where people lose hope,
we got a problem.
We have a huge problem.
We got a problem. You know, we've already had stories here, David, of camps, concentration camps, kinds of camps to holding people are being built around the country, old military bases. I mean, something's going on, and I think that they're prepared for something to go on.
Well, it's scary when you look at the, you know, even you see the kind of, you know, there's a sense of hostility toward the financial, you know, in some respects with good reason, but, you know, the financial system that, you know, I'm very intrigued by this whole Bernie Madoff thing. This was the scam artist who ran the Ponzi scheme on Wall Street, and, you know, and whether it's 35 or 37 or 50 billion that he.
But, and he's only one of few that probably has been doing this.
Yeah,
you know, they nailed a guy in India.
The guy in India, and you look back and you look around and you say, look, you know, this whole system that we have, this capitalist system, it depends on a certain amount of trust. You know, it depends on that we have confidence. And you say, how many more of these things can we have to the where we get to the point where people just say, I don't trust it, and I don't trust to re-enter the economy, and they, you know, and they have their capital, you know, they just say, I don't care what it earns, you know, just keep it there, and I'll you know, if it's in short-term government debt and earning very little, so be it. But it's scary when you look at the crisis of confidence that we have with these kind of these breakouts. And, you know, when I look at the...
And he gets to stay in his $7 million penthouse suite.
Well, and what's so annoying is that it's... what, you know, it'd be one thing if the guy had a tear in his eye as he walked out of the courthouse and said, I'm humiliated in what I've done to so many friends and so many worthwhile charities, and I've inflicted a lot of harm and pain to a lot of people.
There's no remorse.
But he has that smug look, that little smirk, like, you know, I pulled it off. for all these years, and all right, I got caught. But it's just...
Maybe he's just insane.
Yeah, well, I doubt that. I think there's some people who are just corrupt. You know, there's a certain, you know, they have no core, no fiber, and I think that's this guy. But I worry, you know, because, you know, when you... I mean, this may sound a little extreme, but when I look at the behavior of our, and I'm not talking about the local banker, because I think, you know, these local bankers, you know, the local or even the mid-sized banks, they get lumped in with these, and these are honest people. But when I look at the big Wall Street institutions, these, and I look at the way they behaved, you know, in hiding risk. And the last time I was on your program, we talked about all this, how the banks, you know, people say there aren't any regulations. Well, there are a lot of regulations for banks. And there's special regulations that say, and it's an international agreement, but the regulations say if you're going to take on, if you're a bank and you're going to take on a greater risk, you have to put greater capital, rainy day capital aside.
But they never had that.
Well, here's what they did is in the last 10 years, they came up with a scheme to set up these independent, you know, financial vehicles outside of the bank. And you say, why would they do that? Well, they were using all this funny paper, and they were issuing, they were putting their assets all together. In this case, their mortgage assets, dicing and slicing them up into little pieces, and diversifying them. It was like building a giant salad. And they call that securitization. And then they were selling individual salad bowls, you know, to all over the world. What they do is they would sell the salad to their independent vehicles for huge fees. And so they, you know, I know this is complicated to a lot of listeners, but essentially the banks were getting around those regulations, those capital standards. They weren't putting up the capital because they were hiding this risk, you know, on these independent vehicles. And they did that across the board. I don't care what institution, whether it was Citi or whether it was Bear Stearns or Goldman Sachs.
They were all doing it.
They were all doing that. And you know, look, it's not. I'm not saying that's quite the equivalent of Bernie Madoff and a Ponzi scheme, but it wasn't straightforward. It wasn't what you should be doing. It was hiding something. And you know, I look at that and I say, no wonder, you know, it's not just the total scaremongers. I mean, these are people, you know, this is Bob Rubin. I mean, these are people who should have known better, who should have stood up and said, look, we need to disclose what we're doing to the markets, and we can't just set up these things. You know why the you know what the calculation was? They bet that they could sell this paper for fees and shove it off into these independent vehicles, which would like a dumping ground.
And they never expected it to collapse.
They figured if it collapsed, that the parent company, which had this nice balance sheet, would never be penalized. And they miscalculated because the global market not only took down the independent stock price of the independent vehicle, but it would, you know, it took Citi Group's price, their stock price down, and all the other banks. But it was a huge miscalculation. But to be frank, it was based on a falsehood. And I think that is what scares me about where we are right now. We have to get to a point where, you know, where we come to terms with, you know, ultimately it comes down to confidence. You know, I am not confident that our regulators are up to the job. And I don't blame the regulators. I just think that if you are a senior officer at the SEC, for instance, Security and Exchange Commission, and you're going to regulate the financial institutions, you're going to regulate Goldman Sachs, right? Senior officer, I looked up their salaries. They earn somewhere between $160,000 and $190,000, give or take, a year as a senior officer, a senior regulator at the SEC.
All right, which is not bad.
Secretaries at Goldman Sachs earn $200,000.
Exactly.
And these junior executives in the good days were making millions, and their lawyers on Wall Street were making. The lawyers could figure out a way around the regulations, you know, before they were even promulgated. In fact, I asked a Goldman executive less than a year ago. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, if you found a really smart regulator in Washington or, say, in New York, in the New York Fed, or one of these, who was really smart, creative, you'd hire him, wouldn't you? And he said, yeah, probably.
And he'd make a fortune at 10 times his salary.
So the regulators are no match for these wizards, you know, who can figure all kinds of legal but not necessarily straightforward ways around the regulations.
Disconcerting. What has happened, David, to the middle business that used to go out and get venture capital money or could raise money from investors? What's going on with them?
Yeah, they're suffocating financially. I mean, the whole entrepreneurial sector is is very problematic. One of the problems is that when you have a government bailout, and I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not one of these purists that say, you know, the bottom's falling out, the government, I'm not the Herbert Hoover. I think, you know, at times you got to step in. But there are unintended consequences anytime you have a government intervention. And so if the government intervenes and bails out a bank and the bank essentially is beholden to the government, you tend to have winners and losers. And who are the winners? Well, the winners are always the big and the tried and true, and the losers are always the new and the risky and the entrepreneurs.
Yep.
And so you wonder if you're going to have essentially a government-run financial system, you know, ask yourself, could the two guys who invented Google in this environment, could they get financing?
Exactly. Or
they'd be
Apple
told
ones.
To go away.
Yeah. You know, you're right.
You're too risky. I mean, you know, do you want to, if you're a banker, do you want to go up on Capitol Hill and explain how
and the individual
crazy guys with a company called Google and you lost money on them? You don't take those risks.
And the individual investor who has some money, he's not going to play around with that anymore.
No, he's going to be very nervous. But you know what? You know, we have this image of the economy as the static entity. You know, it's like, how do we, you know, I mean, Obama's talking about, you know, I'm going to either save or create 3 million jobs. Well, the economy every year eliminates 7 million jobs. I mean, and it creates 7 million jobs, roughly.
Right.
You know, and then as it grows, it creates sometimes a little more than seven. So the unemployment, now it's the reverse. But these economy, it's not a static entity. It's like a dynamic. It's like an organism, and it's highly dynamic, and it tends to reflect risk taking and innovation, and that is our biggest concern right now is that we're going to see innovation dry up, and because risk takers will not be able to get the capital. I mean, they're going to be, you know, and that's dangerous because this is, you know, the Fortune 500 are net job destroyers. Big corporations, I mean, their goal is to increase productivity. How do they do that? They invest in machines to eliminate jobs. The jobs come from these small enterprises, the small startups.
Absolutely.
And the small startups, they are the ones that are the least politically plugged in, because they don't look sophisticated. They're the guy again. The two geeky guys who started Google, they're not the guys that you expect. I mean, the classic example is, you know, in the 30s, a guy named Chester Carlton, you know, working in his garage,
mm-hmm,
or his kitchen,
mm-hmm,
I guess, and he comes up with an electrostatic printing process. And at the time, if you wanted something copied, you'd go to a mimeograph company. So he goes to all the mimeograph companies all over New York, New Jersey, and Philadelphia, and they all tell him to go away. So he sets up this shop in his kitchen, and eventually it becomes Xerox.
You got it.
You know, but at some point you have to be able to finance that, and you need a climate of buoyancy where that's conducive to risk taking. And when you end up with a heavily politicized financial system, look, it's kind of a tautology or a truism. Enterprises that have yet to exist, you know, that are the entrepreneurial ones or the new ventures, they don't have lobbyists in Washington to get them the money.
I was reading where a company several years ago, they were emerging into the fingerprint identification business at stores. So, you know, you'd be able to do that and buy your goods and services that way. They raised about $100 million, and they go under. Now, and that was an economic climate, David, that pushed for things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That would never happen today.
No. I mean, we are so dependent on innovation. I mean, here we have this infrastructure spending project or proposal coming from Washington, which, again, I think
it's better than nothing, right?
We can't have Herbert Hoover, running things. So you got to do something. But we have an economy that's 85% service oriented, and we're talking about building a lot of bridges and roads.
Well, we do that well.
We do that well. But tell me, are we, you know, and other construction projects, are we going to, is the white-collar guy in a cubicle who's been laid off, is he going to now become, you know, a bricklayer? Is he going to become an electrician overnight?
No.
Not easy.
No, he needs to get skilled for that.
No, and you end up, so, you know, it's very, very tough to target a service economy that's really innovation. It depends more than ever on ideas and the constant implementation of new ideas to the mix.
What if they just erased the slate? Simply erased it. You know, you got a house, no mortgage anymore. Done. It's your house, no mortgage. Don't worry about it. Everything's gone. You have cars as of today. Anybody with debt, it's all gone. Your credit cards, all gone. We're starting over.
Well, I think, you know, as I say, my suspicion is we may end up there, and the way it'll work is just the financial institutions. That's probably why you don't want to be holding a bank stock. Now, if you're in a bank, I think and you're a depositor, that's different. They will protect the depositors because that can allow a 30 run. But if you're bank stock, you know, then you, as I say, you privatize them after you remove the toxic waste and then move on, and it's a big loss for the shareholders. But, you know, look, these, to tell you the truth, I'm appalled at just the whole notion that Washington is, particularly the Treasury under Secretary Paulson, they seem to idolize these banks. I mean, like...
They're like gods.
We have to save the banks. Well, you know, nobody wants bank failure by any means, but I think these are hardly noble institutions. They need to, you know, in some cases, they are just giant dinosaurs that can't get out of their way.
Absolutely. Stay with us. We're going to be back for the final hour with you, David. We're going to take phone calls next when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Last hour of the program, hypnotherapist Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins us as we talk about past lives.